Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Okaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we have two very special guests lined up for you. In the first half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the rather controversial difference between men and women. If you've been watching the presidential elections, you know there's been quite a bit of debate about sexism, about the fortunes of Hillary Clinton, and now Sarah Palin. And the question is, are women up to the task? Is the female brain really different from the male brain? Well, political correctness would say that there is no difference, that it's just environmental upbringing effects. However, we also have Professor Simon Baron Cohen of Cambridge University in England, author of a rather interesting book. It's called, quote, The Essential Difference, The Truth About the Male and Female Brain and Autism. And he has a rather novel but interesting theory that is testable. And that theory is that there's a continuum. There's actually a continuum between so-called female to so-called male attributes in thought, going all the way out to the extreme form of autism. And so once again, he thinks he can link the female brain, the male brain, and autism. And of course, in his book, he's very careful to say that this does not translate into discriminating against people. It does not translate into segregating people on the basis of these kinds of studies. It's a study that is ongoing, but brain scans and also studies, he claims, indicates that there is a, quote, essential difference. And then in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on a very distinguished guest, physicist Paul Davies. He's the author of over 25 popular books, mainly on cosmology, physics, and science. And he's also the winner of the $1 million Templeton Prize, which is supposed to bridge the gap between faith and science. His latest books talk about how to build a time machine, the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations in outer space, and exobiology. So in the second half of Exploration, we're going to leap into the great unknown, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and maybe even time machines. And so once again, our first special guest will address a question which is quite relevant today, because everyone's talking about Sarah Palin and the fading fortunes of Hillary Clinton. So our first special guest, once again, is Professor Simon Baron Cohen of Cambridge University in England, author of the book The Essential Difference, The Truth About the Male and Female Brain and Autism. Let's talk about the evidence, because that's what's the key to the whole thing. Mm. Everyone has anecdotes about men and women. We gossip about this all the time. But let's talk about, first of all, about children, infants, and how they play. In your book, you cite that these differences seem to emerge even in young infants that are just a few weeks old. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, we certainly know that by 1 year old, 1 year of age, boys and girls are showing different kinds of behavior. For example, in the toys they choose to play with, that little boys will more often choose to play with constructional toys, mechanical toys, like toy vehicles. And little girls will more often choose to play with dolls. But of course, that could just reflect differences in what they've been exposed to from their parents. Whereas we also know that even at birth, there are differences on average between boys and girls in terms of what grabs their attention. So we conducted one study of babies at 24 hours old, and we presented each baby with two objects to look at, one at a time. One was a human face, and the other was a mechanical mobile suspended above the crib. What we found was, even on the first day of life, more boys than girls looked for longer at the mechanical mobile, and more girls than boys looked for longer at the human face. And because this difference is emerging so early, it suggests that culture can't be the whole story. Biology must also be playing a part in shaping these sex differences.
Okay, and then you have a chapter, a rather revealing chapter, about summer camp. Now, anyone who's ever been to summer camp knows the rather harrowing experiences as a young adult, teenager, pecking orders start very rapidly, very quickly, different kinds of relationships are established. But now, as a scientist analyzing summer camps, what have scientists been able to glean by analyzing teenagers' behavior in summer camp?
Yes, I mean, summer camp is like a natural experiment where the boys and the girls are separated into cabins, and you can observe what happens in terms of relationships within the cabin. So within the boys, very, very quickly somebody will emerge as, if you like, a leader, and a hierarchy will develop very quickly so that people recognize their position within the little social hierarchy. With the girls, although a leader may emerge, it's less structured, and quite quickly that hierarchy fragments so that girls end up mixing in twos or threes rather than staying in the group. So these differences in natural behavior in social situations may reflect that boys are much more focused on the system, in this case a social system, and where they are in the pecking order, whereas girls are much more focused on the relationship one-to-one.
And you also mentioned that bullying is actually a way in which the alpha male begins to assert dominance, indicating that he has very little empathy for the person being bullied. And even the beta males also kick the person being bullied when he's down.
Yeah, this is very sad, but many listeners may sort of recognize this from their experience, that the person who emerges as the natural leader in the cabin is often, he often has obtained this position by picking out who is the weak individual and contrasting himself and his, as it were, his strength against this individual who can be easily picked on and bullied. And this is a sign not just of establishing a system, a social hierarchy, but as you say, people are rising in the hierarchy through reduced empathy.
Now, you also mentioned that among young boys, you can either A, assert how strong you are and how big muscles and what dominating characteristics you are, or you can also assert expertise in certain activity that's very useful for the group. So there are two ways of establishing a hierarchy within that group, right?
That's right. And, you know, that second route is perhaps less obvious and more interesting, but typically boys will practice one particular skill or technique which itself involves systemizing. For example, it might be a musical technique, learning to play the guitar in a particular way so that they become essential if somebody is forming a band, or it may be some sporting technique so that they become an essential player in the team if it's, for example, a team game like soccer. But either way, these are ways in which boys can fit into the social hierarchy through using systemizing skills.
Now, it's sometimes stated that when men get together, they very rapidly establish a social hierarchy. So eye contact and who bows more and stuff like that are very evident. While with women, it's more fluid. Best friends, alliances, gossip, and stuff like that. They say, well, who knows for sure, but it's sometimes said that the women relate to each other differently. What have these studies on summer camps with women revealed?
Well, it's not just the studies of summer camp, but it's also analysis of language in the workplace. There have been a number of studies looking at the linguistic differences between men and women, boys and girls. And some of the differences include women and girls using more terms that refer to emotions, talking more about each other's feelings, almost as if they're using language to achieve intimacy more quickly. Whereas for men and for boys, often the language is much more focused on activities that they might share, which allows their boys and men to talk about a shared focus, a shared hobby, often around systems. It might be the car, it might be the recent scores at the game, but doesn't have the same effect of accelerating intimacy in a relationship.
Now, if we compare humans to animals, we know that in the animal kingdom, like wolves, for example, the alpha male holds his head up high, while the beta males lower their head, exposing their neck, which is, of course, quite a sign of vulnerability and submission, because your neck is quite vulnerable to being attacked. And that establishes the pecking order there. Now, in human societies with women, you mention social gossip being the counterpart of grooming behavior that we see in primates. Could you elaborate that relationship between social gossip and social grooming among primates?
Well, all primates need to survive in the social group. At least the majority of primates are social. And there are different ways in which you can establish alliances or relationships that you can depend on. And in males, it may be coming to the rescue of another individual in a fight, knowing that when your time comes, you may be able to depend on that person rescuing you. But in females, it may be much more related to grooming in non-human primates, that's to say, just showing support and interest. And when it comes to human primates, to females in particular, they may be using language in a very similar sort of way, so that conversation is very fluid. It may be moving very rapidly from one topic to another, but the prime function is just to bind individuals together, to feel in touch with each other.
In your book, you're very careful to say that many of the things which seem to be genetically bound are in fact influenced by nurture and upbringing, as well as by nature and genetics. And you also are very careful to say that these results should not be used to put down one sex vis-a-vis the other sex. Now, you also mentioned that men very rarely admit weakness. Men very rarely exhibit empathy in these experiments, while with women, they use admission of weakness as one way to form bonding. Could you elaborate on that whole process by which people relate to other people vis-a-vis strength and weakness?
Well, if it is true that females have as a high priority to empathize with others, then for one person to reveal their difficulties, their problems, and to elicit sympathy, in a sense that only accelerates empathizing or facilitates it. Whereas for men, if the prime agenda is not so much empathizing as establishing your place within the system, then to admit weaknesses and difficulties may even mean that you slide downwards in the system. And instead, the way to at least maintain your position in the hierarchy or to rise is to reveal your areas of strength.
Now, you also say that outsiders coming into summer camp, and we've all had that experience of being the outsider coming into an in-group that's already established. Women can ingratiate themselves by figuring out what the social order is within the women's group, while with men, if you barge in and simply muscle in, you may be essentially expelled from the group, so that men and women have different strategies by which they enter a new group, right?
Yeah. And this is even apparent long before summer camp, when kids are starting to go to school, or even in preschool, where it appears that girls are much more welcoming to the newcomer in the group, almost as if they are sensitive to the fact that it's going to be a difficult transition for the new person. For young boys, they're far less likely to show, if you like, welcoming behaviors to the newcomer, may even ignore the new child in the group, so that the child has to wait patiently to be able to be part of the group.
Okay. Now, also, when people chat idly at the coffee table or the water cooler, they do mention differences between men and women, which may or not be valid. For example, men, they say, when they have to go from A to B, have a mental map in their mind. They like to have maps. They very rarely ask people for directions. They hate to ask people for directions, they say. And women, they say, use landmarks by which to navigate from point A to B, and they have no problems asking people for help. But, well, what are your thoughts as a scientist?
Well, there is evidence to support these anecdotes. Of course, you know, when somebody develops a map a mental map of an area. Effectively, what they're doing is, again, systemizing, but they're using a geometric system or a navigational system, usually based around the compass. In contrast, if you're using landmarks as your strategy for getting from A to B, probably you're relying much more on language. You've given yourself, if you like, some word to remind you, turn left at one point or turn right at another. That's not so much based on a geometric system. It's just simply good use of language to help your memory.
Now, in the United States, we have the SAT exams taken by high school kids to get into college. Every test, every analysis of the SAT show that, well, boys seem to be better at manipulating objects, three-dimensional objects, for example, while women seem to be better with language and words. Well, is that really true, you think, or is it just one of these statements that seem to become an urban legend?
Let me start that again. The evidence is supported by experiments. So if you give college students math tests or language tests, you do find more males scoring at the upper levels on the math test and more females scoring at the upper level on the language test. And these differences, in some cases, are present very early. So when you look at toddlers, at two-year-old children, or even younger, at their language development, girls are talking earlier and they have larger vocabularies from as young as 18 months old.
Okay. Now, we also have popular books like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and scientists react in horror with regards to these books. However, is there some justification for anecdotal evidence, like, for example, men like to watch football games on the weekends while women prefer to shop and gossip? Is there some basis for these things, or is it just, once again, just popular fluff?
Well, sometimes the anecdotes are telling us something important, but anecdotes are not evidence, and it doesn't matter how many anecdotes you collect, it still doesn't count as evidence. What you really need are systematic studies where you can count or measure the differences between males and females. But the idea that men are from Mars, women are from Venus, in a way paints too extreme a picture. It suggests that, as it were, we've come from different planets and that the differences between the sexes are almost incompatible. Whereas the reality, when you look at the evidence, is that the differences between males and females are much more subtle, that we can both empathize and we can both systemize. And the difference is more a matter of degree, how much one sex does each of these things.
Now, what about brain scans of the brain, when the brain is shown images of faces, for example, or images of three-dimensional objects? What do brain scans show of the activity of the brain? For example, is the female brain more active in terms of analyzing emotions on a face that they see? Is the male brain perhaps more active in terms of manipulating geometry and objects?
Some studies are beginning to look at brain activity between males and females. And a very famous study came out from Yale where it was shown that during a language task, females are more likely to use both hemispheres in the brain, whereas males are more likely to just use one hemisphere, the left. So this is just suggesting that the differences we see in terms of behavior may also be reflected in brain activity, that the male and female brain, on average, may be going about the task quite differently.
Now, in the back of your book, you actually have pictures of people's eyes with expressions, very characteristic expressions, and lots of pictures of people's eyes reflecting different emotions. And the question is, are women better at reading emotions than men are? Some people say men are clueless when it comes to empathizing with other people's emotions. But what do the studies show?
Yeah, again, the differences are not extreme. They're much more subtle than that. So it's not that men are clueless, but it is the case that when you have a challenging test, for example, reading emotions just from somebody's eyes, where you don't have the rest of the face to help you, that women do score significantly higher on such a test. And this can be taken as one aspect of their better empathy.
Okay, now let me play devil's advocate, okay? Let me say, bah, humbug, it's all nurture. For example, you could argue that women are rewarded, socially rewarded, for being a team player and reading people's emotions. So they get better at it because they get rewarded. While men get socially rewarded for being the alpha male, they get their picture in the school newspaper and all the people pat them on the back for being such a great guy.
Sure.
What do you say when other people say that it's all nurture and has nothing to do with nature?
Well, we don't want to discount the importance of nurture. And the examples you've just given surely play some part. So we know that boys and girls are encouraged in different ways. But we know that it can't be just nurture because, for example, we saw the difference was evident at the first day of life before culture or experiences had much part to play. But we also know that if you look at the effect of hormones measured in the womb produced by the fetus, particularly testosterone, sometimes thought of as the male hormone, but that seems to have an effect not just on brain development, but also behavior postnatally. So this is an example where biology is creating some of the sex differences that we observe.
Now, as you know, in the United States, we had this huge controversy when the president of Harvard, Professor Summers, made what people think are inappropriate comments, but he was trying to focus light on the fact that there are very few women, for example, in physics. But what are your thoughts? Do you think that it was blown out of proportion? Do you think that he was insensitive? Do you think he was onto something? Or do you think that he was just clumsy?
I think that when the story first came out, not much context was given, either by him or in any press release. And so it was difficult to understand or judge the comments. I think that Professor Summers could, first of all, have distinguished between the scientific evidence and the educational policy. Because as we've discussed, the scientific evidence does suggest that on average, the sexes do differ in subtle ways. But when it comes to educational policy, for example, do we want more women in science? And in particular, do we want more women at the top levels of science? Those are policy issues which may be almost independent of the kinds of research we've been discussing. We could, for example, be making science departments much more friendly towards women applicants. We could be trying to encourage more women to apply in the first place. There are many different factors that might change the possibilities for women not just entering science but staying in the field. So there's some regret, really, that the scientific issue was blurred with the policy issue.
Okay, now let's change gears a little bit because you also have a fascinating section about autism. Now, on Exploration, we've had programs on autism before, but you make some rather interesting observations. You say that in some sense, autism may reflect an extreme form of the S brain. Could you elaborate that theory of yours?
Well, if we accept for a moment that males are more likely to have a profile of strong systemizing along with less strong empathy, then if we take the extreme of the male brain, that would be somebody whose empathy is below average, but their systemizing might be unusually strong. And some studies are suggesting that that profile corresponds to individuals on the autistic spectrum. And so far, we've really focused on testing this in relation to people with Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism in individuals with otherwise normal intelligence and language. Well, you can see that these individuals may become obsessed by one system or another. It may be mathematics, it may be chess, or it may be collecting an object, a set of objects. But at the same time, they have a lot of social difficulties because they find it so hard to pick up on other people's feelings.
Now, I was fascinated by your observation about Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton, to a physicist, has almost like godlike status. He was, in some sense, the first modern scientist of all time. However, he was socially inept, cold. He had no friends that we could speak of, analyzing his entire career. He was elected member of parliament, and we only have one expression from him, one speech that he ever gave as a member of parliament, and that's when he asked for the window to be shut because it was drafty inside the hall. So he was a man who had almost no bonding with other beings. Some people say maybe he was homosexual because he had no relationships with women, but forget that. He had no relationships with men either. So do you think that he might have had Asperger's?
Well, it's always very difficult to make any diagnosis on somebody who's no longer alive because of the very examples you've given where all we have is fragments from biographies. We don't really know whether there may be other parts of his personality or behavior that simply never made it into the record, which might give us a different picture. But from what we know, it certainly sounds like he was very accomplished when it came to systemizing his physics, for example, which is clearly a system. But at the same time, some of the descriptions of his social skills and social interests suggest he was quite remote and not very involved in close relationships. So this may have suggested a picture of Asperger's syndrome, but we have to be very careful about retrospective diagnosis.
We should also point out that if the professor is correct, it means that Asperger's syndrome, being a mild form of autism, may actually confer to these individuals terrific mathematical skills that is actually seen in history. For example, we have the strange case of Isaac Newton, perhaps the greatest mathematical genius of all time. However, he was pathologically incapable of small talk or engaging in simple conversation. Now people believe that perhaps Isaac Newton had Asperger's syndrome. And we also have the case of several Nobel Prize winners who were pathologically shy but had tremendous mathematical skills. Perhaps they simply suffered from Asperger's syndrome. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Professor Simon Baron-Cohen of Cambridge University in England, author of a controversial book called The Essential Difference, The Truth About the Male and Female Brain and Autism. And so this is quite germane to the discussion today concerning whether or not people like Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin are qualified for some of the highest offices in the United States. Well, stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we leap into outer space with Professor Paul Davies, the author of over 25 books on cosmology, physics, time machines, aliens from outer space, you name it, he has addressed these questions. And so we're going to bring him on in the second half of Exploration. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned. Welcome back to the second half of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about something that's quite hot right now, and that is the difference between the male and the female brain. especially because Hillary Clinton and now Sarah Palin have figured so prominently in the various Democratic and Republican conventions. And our special guest was Dr. Simon Baron Cohen of Cambridge University in England, author of the book The Essential Difference, The Truth About the Male and Female Brain in Autism. And he had a rather controversial theory saying that there's a continuum of brains from extreme female brains to male brains going on to Asperger's syndrome and even autism as a function of an extreme form of the male brain. And now in the second half of exploration, we're going to leap into outer space with Professor Paul Davies of Arizona State University in Phoenix, Arizona. He's the author of over 25 books on everything from cosmology, time machines, to UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence. And today we're going to talk to him about some of the latest developments in cutting-edge physics. He's also the winner of the $1 million Templeton Prize, given to the scientists who can help to bridge the gap between faith and reason. So once again, the special guest in the second half of exploration is Professor Paul Davies, author of over 25 books on cosmology and physics. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor Paul Davies. He's a physicist from Australia, an author of over 25 books on the cutting edge of physics and science. And today we are talking about exobiology and the struggle to find life in outer space. What about the possibility of life on Mars or throughout the universe? What about the possibility of intelligent life perhaps visiting the planet Earth? So once again, our special guest today is Professor Paul Davies. He's the winner of the Templeton Prize, a $1 million prize given to people who can bridge the gap between science and religion. And so today we are talking about exobiology, life in outer space, black holes, and even the possibility of time travel with Professor Paul Davies. Now, you've written a number of very interesting books, among them about the question of life in outer space. And you have a theory that perhaps life originated on the Earth, actually from Mars. So first of all, what are your thoughts about life in the universe? Is it quite rare, as some people have mentioned on this radio program? Professors Ward and Brownlee say, bah, humbug. The Earth may be unique in the universe, say Professors Ward and Brownlee. Other astronomers say that the whole universe must be teeming with life. What are your thoughts?
I think you've summarized very well what is the central dichotomy of the whole subject of astrobiology. Now, in recent years, I've traded my physics and cosmology for astrobiology. I've become very interested in how life began and whether it is just a chemical freak that has happened once in the observable universe, or whether the laws of physics, the laws of nature generally, are inherently bio-friendly, so that life will pop up wherever there are Earth-like conditions. And it may seem extraordinary that you can have an entire discipline called astrobiology where even that basic question has not been settled. There are scientists, very distinguished scientists, prepared to speak for both ends of that spectrum. For example, Jacques Monod, famous French Nobel Prize winner, a biologist who said many years ago that we are alone in the universe. On the other hand, Christian De Duve, also a Nobel Prize winner, thinks that there is some sort of inbuilt trend in nature that will fast-track matter to life, and he talks about life being a cosmic imperative and that the universe will be teeming with it. What I usually say as my response is that scientifically we can find no reason why that matter has to turn into life. That is, that there is nothing in the laws of physics, when I look at them, that has life written into them explicitly. Life is, after all, a particular state of matter. It's the most remarkable state we know. We have solids and liquids and gases, and we have the living state, which is just totally astounding from the point of view of physicists. It looks so weird that it's easy to believe that maybe it's happened only once. But if I put on my philosopher's hat and say, what do I believe, what would I really like to be the case, then I would like to think that we live in a universe which is intrinsically bio-friendly, that it's a universe that will encourage matter to turn into life under a wide range of conditions. The only way we're ever going to settle this is to find a second sample of life somewhere in the universe. That is, another place where life has started from scratch, independently of life on Earth. And most people say, well, Mars, that's the place to go, because within our solar system, it's certainly the most Earth-like of the other planets, and the one that we know, at least in the past, had conditions that could have hosted life. The problem is about Mars that we know Earth and Mars trade rocks on a regular basis. This is because Earth and Mars get hit by comets and asteroids with enough force to splatter rocks right around the solar system. And over the course of history, there have been a huge number of Mars rocks that have come to Earth, and there will have been some Earth rocks that have gone to Mars. And I believe that if there was life on one of these planets, it would very soon spread to the other one, simply because microorganisms can hitch a ride inside these rocks and be protected from the harsh conditions in outer space, and in a dormant state could easily survive long enough to make the journey from one planet to the other. And I happen to think that Mars is rather more favorable than Earth as the cradle of life. The reason for that is Mars is a smaller planet, so it probably cooled a bit quicker and suffered less from the giant impacts that afflicted the early billion years or so of the solar system. And because it lacked a global ocean, the worst scenarios of these large impacts would not have come to pass on Mars. On the Earth, if it was hit by an object, say, 500 kilometers across, and this must have happened because we know the moon was struck by such objects, would have released enough energy to boil the oceans and swathe the entire planet in superheated steam, would have sterilized everything down to the depth of about a kilometer. That was less likely to happen on Mars. So I think life started on Mars and then came to Earth later inside rocks ejected from Mars. So if we go to Mars now and find that there's life there or was life there in the past, it doesn't necessarily mean life has happened twice. It could well be that it has just happened once in the solar system and has spread around. So therefore, to find a second sample of life, we may have to go much farther afield, perhaps to Europa, perhaps outside the solar system altogether. And that's going to take a very long time, unless, of course, the SETI people get lucky and pick up a message from an intelligent community somewhere else in the universe. But that really is a long shot.
Now, Fred Hoyle, who you mentioned, believed in the panspermia theory. After the meteors stopped bombarding the Earth, life started on the Earth very rapidly, very soon after the impacts ended. And Fred Hoyle, as a consequence, said it couldn't have been an accident. We must have been seeded from outer space. So let's talk about those seeds. There have been these meteorites that have been found, as you mentioned, but there's controversy about those meteorites. Is it conclusive as to whether or not these meteorites have signs of single-celled organisms?
First, let me say that there's general agreement that some meteorites, it's a class called carbonaceous chondrites, have organic substances in them. Now, the word organic doesn't necessarily mean made by life. It means the sort of substances that life uses. For example, proteins are made of amino acids, and there's a famous meteorite that fell in Australia in the late 1960s called the Murchison meteorite. I have a piece of it at home, and this is full of amino acids. But you don't have to conclude these amino acids are the detritus of once living things. It could simply be the organic gunk from which life may have arisen in the first place on a planet, say, like the Earth or Mars. Now, there have been claims from time to time that within this organic gunk there are microfossils of living organisms. And these claims have been made not just for the Murchison meteorite, but others too, for many, many decades. It's one of these stories that keeps coming around. And I have worked with Richard Hoover at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. He's a NASA astrobiologist And he's convinced that there are signs of life in a number of these meteorites, and we've taken a look together, and he finds little features that certainly look to the eye as if they are little microfossils, but I'm very cautious myself because I work with people who make a living from looking for the earliest traces of life in earth rocks. They go to Western Australia where there are 3.5 billion year old rocks, and they look for microfossils in those. And again, you see these shapes, but just because something looks like a little microbe doesn't mean it really is. There are all sorts of chemical and other processes that can make shapes that are like microbes, but of course they're not living at all. So I remain very cautious about the evidence for life in meteorites. I might also say, in connection with Fred Hoyle, I have a soft spot for Fred Hoyle because he gave me my first job in 1970, and I was always fascinated by his idea that life could perhaps spread across the universe, not inside rocks, but naked microbes being blown through space by the pressure of starlight or sunlight. This is an old idea, goes back to Svante Arrhenius 100 years ago, a Swedish chemist who suggested that life could spread across the universe by this mechanism. Arrhenius didn't know about cosmic rays, and the big problem about an unprotected microbe in space is the radiation. Cosmic rays, ultraviolet rays from the sun and other stars, and solar flares. These would all prove pretty deadly to a completely unprotected microbe. So I think there's a big difference between a little bug hitching a ride in a rock and being literally exposed to the very harsh conditions of outer space. I think the chances of life spreading from one star system to another across totally empty space is very remote. But the problem about spreading inside a rock is that the chances of a rock that's, say, knocked off the Earth hitting another Earth-like planet in another star system is very remote. So trading rocks between Earth and Mars or Earth and Venus, yes, that happens all the time. But knocking a rock off the Earth and going several light years across the galaxy and hitting another Earth-like planet, that's very unlikely to happen. So I think if life does spread around, it's likely to remain just within the one star system and not to go from one star system to another.
Okay, now some skeptics would say that pond scum or slime could be found on other distant planets, but intelligent beings that could build starships to visit us are perhaps out of the question. So what do you think, therefore, about, well, where are they? Where are these intelligent people if they are out there? Do they have flying saucers? Have they abducted humans and performed forbidden experiments on them? What are your thoughts now about intelligent life in outer space?
The hardest step is the first step, that is going from non-life to life. That is the really big jump. It seems to me that once life has got going, it's at least in with a chance of developing intelligence. The trouble is we have only one record of life here on Earth, and it's always difficult to know which features are special, just frozen accidents, and which are to be expected under a wide range of conditions. But I could be persuaded that given long enough, intelligence may emerge on other planets. I don't believe the stories about alien abductions or even alien visitation, because it seems to me that the chances of an alien civilization having roughly the same level of technology as us at roughly the same time, given that the universe is about 14 billion years old and our solar system is 4.5 billion years old, it takes life 4 billion years to evolve to the point of intelligence, that I just don't think it's very probable you're going to have two nearby inhabited planets at the same technological or even similar technological level. But I do think it's worth looking for a message. It could be a message that was sent a long time ago. Some of my colleagues sweep the skies with radio telescopes, hoping to stumble across a message from an alien civilization. I happen to think there's a better way. I think that if ET wanted to leave us a message, rather than beaming radio waves at us that may be for millions and millions of years, it would be better for them to have a set and forget strategy. And just recently I conjectured that it might be worth looking inside the genomes of Earth organisms to see if in the junk DNA, which seems to serve no useful purpose in these organisms, that there might be a message from ET. Now, of course, this is a wildly speculative idea, but I don't think it's any more speculative than looking for messages with radio telescopes. After all, we now know that looking with radio telescopes generates a huge amount of data, and there's a very popular program called SETI at Home, and school kids like to put this on their computers and hope that they will get the message from ET. This has been followed by the genome community, who also have vast amounts of data. So there's Genome at Home, and I'm suggesting combine together SETI at Home with Genome at Home and see if there's something a bit fishy about some sequences of junk DNA. Who knows? ET could have just left us a message there.
And what about visitation? Of course, distances to stars are quite large. Enrico Fermi, who helped to build the atomic bomb, asked the question, well, where are they? I mean, some people think that we're not very interesting to them. They're going to be millions of years more advanced than us. Other people think that maybe they have come by and are disguised as humans. But what are your thoughts about actual contact?
I think physical contact in the flesh is extremely improbable, and the reason for that is that we can have two scenarios. One, that life is extremely rare, in which case the chances of contact between any two communities is going to be very remote anyway, or that the universe is teeming with life, and the people who like this sort of thing, the people who conjecture about ET and about other civilizations and about contact, assume that there are lots of them out there. And then, of course, it becomes much easier to communicate either by radio or by sending messages. I mentioned about ET planting a message in our DNA. They don't have to come here physically to do that. They can send viruses that would infect any DNA-based organisms and implant the message. And it's much cheaper to send a virus than it is to send the proverbial little green man. I think if there is lots of intelligent life in the universe, there will already be a network of communication by some means or other, and it simply won't be necessary for them to travel bodily from one planet to the other to obtain information about it. But I think this Fermi paradox does have some force, because we need only one aggressively expanding advanced intelligent community before the entire galaxy could be engulfed, it's very hard to know why, if there are all manner of different organisms and all manner of different communities, why there isn't at least one that is aggressive and expanding. And I can only hope that there's some sort of law of nature that says that aggressive expanding communities self-destruct before they can destroy everybody else. But I know of no compelling reason why there should be such a law.
Now let's shift gears a little bit. Let's assume that an intelligent race is quite advanced, millions to billions of years ahead of us, in which case they may begin to tease apart the fabric of space and time. Now, you recently wrote a book about building a time machine. So first of all, give us an indication of how difficult it is, the amount of energy or exotic materials that in a very advanced civilization would require in order to either zip across galaxies or zip across time.
Traveling into the future isn't very difficult. We've known for about 100 years since Einstein published his special theory of relativity that traveling at close to the speed of light will enable you to leap into the future. And that is just a matter of cost, not a matter of physical principle. That to get close to the speed of light is a very expensive exercise, both in money and energy. But we can imagine that in another 10,000 years or something, we can develop a propulsion system much better than our rockets and maybe achieve travel into the future. But I think the really fascinating thing is travel into the past, a general purpose time machine that will enable you to go forward or backward in time. And curiously, Einstein's theory of relativity does not forbid this. There is nothing in that theory to say we cannot travel back in time. But it seems a deeply weird thing to do. People worry about what happens if you go back and shoot your mother dead in the cradle or something. Then you get into these paradoxical loops. The paradoxes are not devastating. So long as you have self-consistent narratives, so long as everything hangs together properly, there's no real impediment to going back in time. But building a time machine to do it is much, much harder than going forward in time. The best bet that we have is something called a wormhole in space. A wormhole is a bit like a black hole, only different, whereas if you fall into a black hole, it's a one-way journey to nowhere. You can't get out again, you're trapped. In the case of a wormhole, it would have an exit as well as an entrance. It would be a little bit like a Stargate. You could jump in one end and come out the other end, maybe somewhere on the other side of the galaxy. And if you can shortcut through space like that, then it's easy to show you can use that to travel through time, forward or backward. And then the problem from the point of view of a technological community is, how do you build such a wormhole? Where do you get it? Now, if we're lucky, wormholes may have been created naturally in the Big Bang, but if we're not lucky, we would have to make such a thing. How do we get started? Well, there's one place that most physicists believe wormholes are forming naturally, but they don't last very long, and that is on a tiny, tiny scale of size, about 20 powers of 10, smaller than an atomic nucleus. There ought to be complicated tangle of wormholes and black holes and tunnels and bridges and all sorts of foamy stuff down at that level, where space and time tie themselves up spontaneously into knots. And if we could pluck a little wormhole out of this space-time foam and somehow expand it up to human proportions, then we'd be in with a chance of making a time machine. But from our present understanding of physics, that looks to be a very, very difficult task, because a wormhole, if we just could magically produce one here in this room, wouldn't remain stable. It would tend to pinch off before anything could get through it. And so to stabilize it, you need to deploy something like negative energy, which is a mysterious concept, but it is one that is known to exist. Negative energy sounds a little bit like negative lunch. You think, well, how can you have less than no lunch? You either have some lunch or no lunch. What is negative lunch? Well, negative energy just means it's energy that is less than the energy of just empty space a long way away from any body. And if you can contrive a state where the energy of space is less than that, then that is by definition negative, and it would have a sort of anti-gravity effect that could keep the wormhole open. And we know that there are particular states, quantum states, that can be produced with reflecting surfaces or with carefully sculpted laser beams that will produce very small amounts of negative energy. If we could find some way of accumulating large amounts of negative energy, we could in principle make a wormhole. I should finish with a conjecture that it may not be quite as hard as this, because if some non-standard theories of gravitation are correct, it may be that these microscopic wormholes and black holes can be produced on a scale much, much larger than this tiny scale of 20 powers of 10, smaller than an atomic nucleus. In fact, on a scale of size that's large enough that it may be possible with the next generation of particle accelerators, like the Large Hadron Collider being built at CERN, the European Particle Physics Lab near Geneva, that they could just make tiny wormholes and tiny black holes. They wouldn't live very long, but maybe just long enough to experiment with some weird time looping effects.
Now, some people say that in order to really study these tiny little foamy objects, you need a, quote, theory of everything. So let me ask you a philosophical question. Personally, I work in string theory, which makes a claim of being a theory of everything. Other people say, bah, humbug, it's impossible to test. But what are your personal thoughts? Do you think there is a theory of everything? Some people believe in the onion theory, where there is a number of infinite layers. Every time you probe deeper and deeper, a new physics emerges. So there is no theory of everything. But just what are your philosophical thoughts in this direction?
I've always been a great fan of the theory of everything. It seems to me that if the universe was, in some sense, infinitely complex, because there are unending layers that we will uncover, then not only does that make science seem a little bit pointless, not science as a technological enterprise, but science as a philosophical quest, if we're never going to get to the end of it, you think, well, what's the point of embarking on it in the first place? But also because everything that I know about the universe through physics and my philosophical position is that it is the universe is thoroughly rational. It hangs together in a coherent and felicitous manner. And this suggests to me that there is some deep underlying theory or order or scheme of things. And whether we will achieve this final theory in my lifetime is, of course, another matter. I follow string theory as best I can, and some of its competitive theories, like loop quantum gravity. And I listen, of course, to the claims that people make, and I can believe that a theory sort of like that might one day at least provide us with an answer to all of the forces and all of the particles and so on. I can believe that, but whether those particular theories are going to do it, I think, is another matter. And you mentioned the really serious issue, which is that you have to be able to test these theories. It's all very well coming up with some elegant-looking mathematical scheme, but unless it makes contact with the real world and real experiment, then it's no more than an ornament.
Now let me ask you the big one, and that's the question of God. Some people say that physicists are the only scientists who can say the word God and not blush. Well, what are your thoughts? Einstein believed in the God of Spinoza. What are your thoughts?
You're quite right that physicists do use the word God a lot, and I've often been asked that, and I say, well, you know, if a biologist gets stuck, they may well have to go to a chemist to solve their problem. A chemist gets stuck, they go to a physicist. If a physicist gets stuck, there's nowhere to go but theology. So because physics is, so to speak, the foundational science, it deals with the really basic issues, like the laws that underpin all of physical reality. It's inevitable that physicists will find themselves asking questions like, well, where do these laws come from? And why those laws? And why do they work so well and give rise to thinking beings like ourselves?
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first special guest was Dr. Simon Baron Cohen, author of the book, The Essential Difference, The Truth About the Male and Female Brain and Autism. And our second special guest was Professor Paul Davies of Arizona State University in Phoenix, Arizona, author of over 25 books on the question of exobiology and cosmology. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, and if you get cable television, you may want to tune in on Sunday nights. I'll be introducing the lineup of shows on the Science Channel. And my latest book is called Physics of the Impossible, which sailed onto the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks running. So once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. Good day.